You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
I cover all things food, from cooking to gardening to fabulous ingredients to junk food, health, sustainability, even policy. You might say I'm obsessed with everything about food. Food is the one substance that connects everything to everything else, and it connects us all. Not only can we not live without it, not only does it determine much of what goes on in the world, but we love it. Hi, and welcome to Food with Mark Bittman. My guest today is a man who's known as a musician and a game-changing musician. 20 years ago, his album Play shot to the top of the charts and changed the way a lot of people thought about and listened to music, at least did for me. There are still songs on there that I listen to, and I've listened to much of his music since then. I'm talking, of course, about Moby, who, aside from his incredible music talent, is a passionate vegan, but not a proselytizing one, and we'll talk about that. There's a big difference. He's never preachy, at least he's never been preachy with me. He has owned a tea house in New York and the wonderful restaurant Little Pine in Los Angeles and Silver Lake, from which some really good recipes came. I wrote about them once. I love talking to him about food and a bunch of other stuff. We talk regularly. We've become friends, and we never don't have a good time, as you'll hear. This interview is no exception. So we'll have that. We'll have some awesome summer recipes. We'll have your questions and more today on Food. Okay, on to recipes. Look, I want this podcast to be as useful as possible, obviously. So I'm going to try to do recipes that aren't pasta with tomato sauce or that aren't mashed potatoes. I'm going to try to do things that are challenging, but challenging in the simplest way possible. So this is a time of year where many people are confronted through farmers markets or CSAs or roadside stands or whatever. They are confronted with vegetables they have no idea what to do with. I mean, this happens to me. I just had a vegetable for lunch. I didn't know what it was. That's another story. One of my thoughts is that I'm going to try to either give you totally basic uses for things that you might not have dealt with before or on uses you haven't thought of for things that you may have too much of. So one thing that everybody says, what the hell am I supposed to do with this, is kohlrabi. And kohlrabi kind of resembles a turnip, and it kind of tastes like a turnip. It can be green, very, very pale green, almost white, purple, not dark, dark beet purple, but eggplant purple or pale eggplant purple, lavenderish. And it can be as big as a softball, but it's better when it's tennis ball size. Like other root vegetables, it can get woody in the center if it grows too large. So you can think of it as a mild turnip. That's kind of what it is. It's certainly in that family. And if it has leaves, those are edible too. So the simplest thing to do with a kohlrabi, and in some ways the best, is to slice it really thin. If the skin is thin, you don't have to peel it. If the skin is thick, you'll want to peel it. But either way, slice it really thin. On a mandolin would be best. Be careful. And dip it in salt and eat that. Or sprinkle it with a little olive oil and salt and eat that. It is like a mild, delicious turnip. And that's kind of my favorite way to eat kohlrabi. However, when there's too much of it, when you're sick of that, try this. Cooking it in a little bit of butter with some cream and some horseradish. Here's what you do. Put a chunk of butter in a skillet. Start melting that. You will add some peeled and cubed kohlrabi, say two of them or three of them, about a pound. Peel them, cube them, add them to the butter. Save the greens if you can. As I said, you don't have to peel them if the skin is thin. Add a chopped onion and cook that at the same time, and cook it until the kohlrabi is almost tender. You can add a tablespoon of water, which will hasten the cooking, but you don't want this to be watery. Add the leaves when the kohlrabi is just about tender and just cook a little bit longer, and then add quarter cup, a half a cup of good heavy cream, and a tablespoon of grated horseradish, either fresh or prepared horseradish is fine also. Just cook that until the mixture becomes creamy, add salt and pepper, serve. That is really, really good. You can use mustard instead of the horseradish if you like also. Dijon mustard would be really good in there. So, kohlrabi, one, raw, two, cooked like that. Enjoy that. Now it's time for my chat with Moby. We'll talk about music and drinking and veganism and drinking and non-veganism and some other things as well. I think it's a hoot. I really had fun doing it and hope you enjoyed listening to it. Thank you for doing this. I wanted to talk a little about veganism, a little about Little Pine, and maybe, if we have time, a little about sobriety, if you're all right with
that. Yeah, that's great.
Well, probably more mine than yours, but whatever. Okay. One of the things I really have liked about you, about our relationship, is that you are a vegan. You have been for X years. What's that blank? How long?
I've been vegan now for 31 years.
That's a while. That's probably as long as anybody. But you don't proselytize and you don't guilt trip. I mean, not to be bad-mouthing vegans in general, but, you know, they tend, their reputation anyway is that they're a little harsh, and yet you're not. So I just kind of wonder where that balance came from and how you're so, you know, we do pretty readily agree on how people should eat, even though we kind of come from opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't want to sound too much like a former philosophy major. In terms of, let's call it like vegan activism, when I first became a vegan, you know, I was a former punk rocker. And so my approach was as confrontational as you can imagine, you know, getting in fights with family members about, you know, why they shouldn't be eating cheese. And at some point I realized that when I was being really confrontational and really aggressive, all I was doing was making people defensive and annoyed, you know, and I have to believe that the goal of activism is not to annoy people,
right?
You know, because when someone's annoyed and defensive, they're really shut off to actually, you know, being open to hearing what you have to say. So at some point I realized that like my being confrontational, my being sort of judgmental and didactic, it was making me feel good. You know, I could feel self-righteous, I could feel smug, but it wasn't actually leading anyone to consider what I was talking about.
Right. Even to think about it, let alone change their actual minds. That was a self-realization that actually happened?
It gradually happened over time. I mean, because I sort of thought that my being, you know, a really militant, confrontational vegan was simply almost like a rational, warranted extension of my beliefs. You know, I thought, you know, if I have passionately held beliefs, I have to express them passionately. But then I guess there's that question of like, what is the ultimate goal of activism and what criteria, you know, I don't want to sound too academic, but by what criteria do you judge your approach to activism? And I sort of took a step back and just realized, as I said, that like by being a douchebag, I was just irritating people.
So what do you say to people now, or do you not say anything?
I mean, honestly, the climate has changed so much, you know, combination of, you know, articles in just about every newspaper, every magazine about, you know, the health consequences of an animal product-based diet, all the movies like What the Health and Forks Over Knives, remarkable TED Talks such as yours that sort of have led everyone to question their approach to eating animals. And so a lot of times I feel like I'm almost a sounding board. Like instead of me having to in any way proselytize, people come up to me and in a weird way almost have less like a Socratic dialogue with themselves while I sit there and say nothing. Or one of my favorite things is when like the newly converted tell me facts that I first read 30 years ago. And I never, I try to be as, I mean, and maybe this is really like douchey and patronizing of me, but I try not to like say to that person like, oh yeah, the facts that you're all excited about are facts that people have known for a long time. Like it's nice that, the newly converted, you know, are excited about these facts, but it's, you know, the facts have been there for a while.
Right. Are more people sort of coming up to you and saying, oh wow, I'm now vegan? Or are they saying, I'm eating a lot less meat than I used to?
Both. I mean, every now and then, out of the blue, someone will randomly come up to me and tell me that they're vegan. Like it just happened recently with Adam Schiff, you know, the congressman from California. I was in my restaurant and he was in my restaurant, Little Pine, and he came up to me like smiling and beaming. And he said, I just wanted to let you know, I'm a vegan now. And I was like, well, that's great. And to put it in perspective, I mean, 31 years ago, one, veganism was so weird, no one knew how to pronounce the word vegan. I remember debates with my fellow vegans back then of like, were we vegans? Were we vegans?
Did vegans?
We eat, you know, like what, and eventually, I guess for some reason we settled on vegan, maybe because it sounds punk rock. I don't know. But also to put it in perspective, like where I live in California in Los Feliz, there are more vegan and vegan friendly restaurants within a 2 mile radius of my house than there were in the entire world in 1987 when I went vegan. But also, I mean, something you and I have talked about is the idea that for a lot of people, there's this sort of binary approach. On one hand, you have like Piers Morgan saying that vegans should be crucified. And on the other hand, you have like militant vegans saying that meat eaters should be crucified. And I find that, I mean, this is true with culture, with politics, is like the middle ground is a much more sort of like calm, rational place to be. It's a lot easier and it's a lot more respectful rather than, you know, just like two people who vehemently disagree with each other screaming at each other on the top, at the top of their lungs.
That is where we meet. So, yeah. I just want to say one more or ask one more thing about this, and that is that so many people seem to think that veganism is an ideal. And for a lot of those people, it feels like an unachievable ideal. And then I have to have this conversation or wind up having this conversation, which is it doesn't necessarily have to be an ideal. What's practical and an ideal is to just eat less meat and eat a lot less meat. And eat more plants and eat a lot more plants and do that for the rest of your life. And somehow, because we are a sort of saints or sinners society, and you know, there is always that kind of odd polar expression of opinions, everybody thinks, oh, well, if I'm not everybody, God knows, but there are many people who seem to think, well, if I'm not a vegan, I'm a failure. I need to be a vegan. And it's just this kind of odd North Star for some people.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of, there's a quote from Voltaire, and I think Obama paraphrased it in his first inaugural address. And he said, don't let the pursuit of the perfect be the enemy of the good. You know, and it applies to just about everything. It applies to exercise. It applies to meditation. It, you know, like it's better to do a little than to do nothing. But it's a hard conversation to have sometimes, because people have get so emotionally entrenched regarding their opinion about eating animals. And I mean, I admit I can be one of those people, but you know, I certainly think, you know, like for my aunts and uncles who are in their 70s, you know, the idea of them becoming militant vegans is a little far-fetched. The idea of them being reducitarians or flexitarians is a lot more achievable. And the truth is everyone benefits, like they benefit, climate benefits, the animals benefit, healthcare benefits, like everything benefits even from that sort of reducitarian, flexitarian approach.
I wanted to talk about Little Pine, which is your restaurant in Silver Lake, right? Which I've eaten at and is great. And you know that. And it's small and charming and vegan and all of that. It also gives all of its, or you give all of its profits to animal rights organizations. And I wanted to know if you started it with that idea, if that was always the case and how that happened and whether you're just a saint or what.
Well, I mean, as you know, opening and running a restaurant is just about the dumbest thing anyone can ever do. Because I used to own a restaurant in New York called Teeny, and I opened it with an ex-girlfriend in around 2002, and it ended up doing okay considering neither one of us had any small business experience and neither one of us had ever worked in a restaurant. So we were utterly clueless, and somehow it did okay. When I ended my involvement with Teeny, I sort of swore to myself I would never, ever in a billion years try to open another restaurant, because, I mean, I'm sure there are harder jobs, but like the fact with the restaurant, as you know, it's super hard to get open. It's incredibly expensive. The margins are terrible. And if you are not perfect every second that you're open, you'll get crucified on Yelp and crucified and, you know, different reviews. So opening a restaurant is hard and dumb. Maybe I'm just a masochist, you know, that I wanted to open a second restaurant after swearing never to do it again. But I also realized, in the world of veganism, there are great podcasts, there are great books, there are great movies, there, you know, there's lots of great vegan media. But there's something really powerful about going into a really nice restaurant with a great wine list and really nice food as almost like a form of really appealing vegan activism. Because nothing in Little Pine, like we give all, yeah, I give all the money to animal rights groups, but there's no criticism or judgment or didacticism in the restaurant. You know, like meat eaters come in and I hope they feel really welcome and looked after. You know, no one criticizes them, you know, for the clothes they're wearing or the fact that they might have eaten at In-N-Out Burger earlier in the day.
It's one of those very, very few vegan restaurants that you could go in and eat at without knowing that it's a vegan restaurant.
I mean, that happens to me a lot where like an older person might come in who's never had vegan food and they'll come up to me after their meal and admit to me, they'll say like, look, I was dragged here. I didn't want to go to a vegan restaurant. And they'll look at me and they'll say, but the food was good and I feel full. And like, to me, that's the reason to go through all the struggle and hardship of getting this, you know, getting a vegan restaurant open and running it, when it sort of potentially changes someone's opinion about veganism and vegan food. You know, again, I'm not looking for that same person to become a vegan evangelist, you know, and suddenly like throwing fake blood on fur coats. But like, if I can just move them just an inch, I feel like that's the reason that we keep our doors open.
That's so great. And I would guess that maybe the giving away the money thing makes it so you can worry a little less about those terrible margins and all of that stuff. I guess you're lucky in that you don't have to make a living on it, so it'll work either way as long as you're not losing too much money.
Yeah, I mean, giving the money away and combining it with my own charitable giving actually makes me work harder on the restaurant than if I was just doing it for selfish reasons or for entrepreneurial reasons. Because also, I mean, we're a small restaurant. Our margins are very small. Like if I was just doing this to make money and be an entrepreneur, I would be the single dumbest entrepreneur in the world.
You do hear restaurant people say that kind of thing a lot. Like, why did I think this was a good idea?
Yep.
I wanted to talk. The last time we saw each other, I had been sober for 2 months, I think, and it's now 6 months. And you've been sober again for X years, not 31, I know, but some impressive period of time.
Well, now I've been sober for 10 years. I applaud you in your sobriety. Seems like it's really working for you. I mean, I think that the difference might be like you're sober for very sort of like rational reasons. And I'm sober because I'm just an old timey falling down alcoholic. And if I drink, I die.
But that is actually the question that I had was this kind of old timey falling down alcoholic definition of alcoholism as, you know, as put forth by gospel pretty much by AA. I didn't stop drinking for any urgent reason, as you said. It just seemed like a good idea at the time, and then it stuck. But then suddenly it turns out that there is this sort of new sobriety movement. There are two or three books written about it, and people are talking about it, which is not about, oh, I'm an alcoholic and I can't take a single drink, but it's sort of about, oh, I think I might prefer being not hungover every morning or five mornings a week or whatever, and I might prefer having my wits about me all the time. I don't know that there's a question here, frankly, but that's what I'm encountering.
Yeah, and if you can do that, that's great. Anyone who can drink in moderation or abstain for really rational reasons, like I think, or even if anyone who can like drink and just have fun and manage the hangovers, I applaud all of that. For right. me, my problem was I'm a true alcoholic addict. Like this is my example of me trying to drink in moderation. About 6 months before I got sober, I was really trying to prove to myself that I could be a normal human being and just have a couple of drinks. So I went out one night to Indochine, you know, on Lafayette Street, and I was with some friends and I was like, okay, I'm going to have two drinks because this is what normal people do. They go out and they have two drinks. Like at most, they have three. At 8 o'clock that morning, I had 15 drinks and had spent $300 on cocaine and was having sex with an Israeli performance artist I had met like 3 hours before that. And then I was hungover for the next 2 days. So that was my best effort at drinking in moderation like a normal human being.
That is a pretty good story. I don't have any such stories, but honestly, I feel better and it's good. So, and I often, you know, it's probably because you're so articulate about it. I often think of you about this stuff, but appreciate your openness. It's really great. Okay, last question. This is the sort of throwaway, and it may be a question that you hate because you probably get it all the time because it's a music question as opposed to a personal question, which is, I mean, I think of Extreme Ways, which is, you know, people think of it as the Bourne theme song with good reason, and I still love it. I guess it's 20 years since I first heard it, roughly 20 years. It's an unavoidable song. You must hear it too. Are you sick of it? Do you hate it? Do you think it's, I love this, it's a work of art, I'm so proud of it? How does it strike you now?
Well, when I was growing up and I first started playing in punk rock bands, my goal as a musician was to put out a 7-inch single that maybe 100 people would buy, and maybe if I was lucky, play a show in New York somewhere that 50 or 100 people would come to. So my baseline for success was so low that everything beyond that has been weird and surprising. And the premise of the question that, like, would I be annoyed at hearing one of my own songs because I've heard it too often? Like, no, for so many reasons. I mean, one, I'm right. A narcissist, and I do actually like listening to my own music. And two, it just never dawned on me when I was growing up that anybody would ever hear a piece of music that I made. So the fact that, like, I was out the other night, and this has happened a few times, like, a guy who used to work at the CIA came up to me and he said, "You do know that Extreme Ways is now the, like, unofficial theme song of the CIA
because
of the Bourne movies." I was like, "Really? Now, that's great. Now tell me, when is Trump going to prison?"
And his answer to that was?
His answer to that was, soon. He said, basically, he was like, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. It's going to be pretty soon.
It's good to hear that from the CIA.
The weird thing about the song Extreme Ways is I wrote it when I was super famous and drinking all the time and the hangovers were gentle, but the lyrics are weirdly prescient because the lyrics are all about bottoming out. And I remember when I wrote it thinking to myself, like, oh, these lyrics are, you know, hopefully they'll never come true. And then lo and behold, they came true. And now that's why I've been sober for 10 years.
Awesome story. All right, we're going to play a little of that now. I'm going to let you go. It's great talking with you. I have to say, I'm slightly in love with you. It's really nice to chat. So,
right back at you.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more food in just a minute. How are you?
I feel guilty saying it, but I'm actually fine. I mean, with so many, I don't know what the plural of apocalypse is. Like, is it apocalypses, apocalypsi? But, like, with so many things happening that are potentially going to destroy the only home we have and our species and other species, like, I was actually reading the Times today, this article about guilt, and I don't know if I have it to the extent that other people have it or specifically around the issues that are triggering guilt for other people, but I do feel sometimes a sense of almost dissociation where, like, if your immediate circumstances are relatively pleasant, are you allowed to enjoy that when the Middle East is falling apart, democracy is under attack, future elections might not even happen, the rainforest is burning down, the pandemic is still raging in certain places, they're burning bodies in India, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, am I allowed to enjoy drinking a cup of organic white tea and reading a pointless article about, you know, the early works of Marcel Duchamp. Like, it almost seems like Nero fiddling as Rome burns, enjoying these small things. But at the same time, there's that moment where you're like, okay, I'm in my living room. I see that the world is falling apart. In this moment, there's nothing I can do. So why not just sort of take a little bit of refuge in your organic white tea and your book about, you know, Schopenhauer or Duchamp and enjoy that? Maybe that's complete bourgeois entitled justification. I have no idea.
You know, I think it was C.P. Snow who said there's the human condition and the social condition, and you can do something about the second, but there's nothing you can do about the first. If you want to go work full time on making the world a better place and give up your personal life entirely, I'm sure you can figure out a way to do that. But I don't know anyone who's built with that ability. And everybody seeks solace and pleasure in their personal life to the extent they can get it. And yes, many people feel guilty about it, I think.
And then there's sort of like, you know, pertaining to the human condition, and not to go down this rabbit hole too far, but like our complete lack of omniscience, which means that the ways in which we think we might fix humanity or fix the world, history's filled with people who were convinced that they were fixing things, and then in hindsight, turns out they were not. Maybe it's, again, just sort of like a bourgeois caution of thinking, oh, I want to make things better, but given that I do not have omniscience, I'm not 100% sure how to achieve that. So I'm just going to, you know, watch an old episode of 30 Rock and drink some tea.
Well, there is an in-between, but I'm not that I'm arguing against watching 30 Rock and drinking tea, but I mean, you're right about that, but I think that argues for, and I hate to say it, I think it argues for caution, a lack of fanaticism, moderation. I mean, that's a word, you know, my younger self is freaking out at hearing me even utter that word. But I think, you know, if we can change things a little at a time, then we can measure the effects of the things that we do and presumably not go commit a Holocaust because we think it's the right thing to do or something. I mean, climate change-wise, many people think we're running out of time, so drastic action is needed. So then where does that leave you?
Yeah, and then the question, because for example, like drastic action, I completely agree. The question would be, what would that drastic action be? You know, like what could any individual, and I completely agree with what you're saying, that I think that, you know, my approach to activism to try and change the world is like every day do something, you know, and try and always have that in your mind, like what more can I do, with the understanding I have limited resources, no omniscience. And so there's a good chance, you know, we might go down a lot of cul-de-sacs saying like, let's try and fix the world this way. And then you go down that cul-de-sac. Like as an early animal rights activist, I thought the best way of advancing animal rights was yelling at people and throwing fake blood on fur coats. And then at some point you realize like, oh, when I yell at people, they don't change their minds. They just simply get annoyed and stop listening. And if I throw fake blood on someone's fur coat, all I've accomplished is pissing off the person wearing the fur coat. Like there's no reasonable dialogue happening. So it's, you know, we do our best with the understanding that we know very little.
I want to hear about three things. I want to hear about Little Pine and the cookbook. I want to hear what you're doing musically. And I want to talk on the record about what you're listening to. Usually I talk to people about what they're cooking, but in your case, I'm more interested in what you're listening to.
Okay, so music-wise, I'm actually putting out a new album on May 28th. I'm also putting out a documentary. This director made a documentary about me. It's called Moby Doc. So the album's called Reprise, and it's basically an orchestral greatest hits. So I spent the last 3 years, yeah, so working with a string quartet, working with a gospel choir, working with a whole bunch of different singers. I mean, some well-known singers, some lesser-known singers. If I'm playing favorites, my favorite vocalist on the album is Chris Christopherson, because he sings a song called The Lonely Night with my friend Mark Lanigan. And these are the voices of experience. These are not 19-year-old pop stars. These are people who've been through the ringer, and you hear it in their voices so clearly. So that, and what's also interesting, it's coming out on Deutsche Grammophon, which is the oldest, probably most respected label in the world. And I just think it's, for me personally, self-involvedly, it's sort of ironic because when I was 16, I was playing in hardcore punk bands, playing to five people a night. When I was 19, I got a job DJing in a dive bar, playing to 10 people a night. I never expected to make music that anyone would listen to, let alone work with orchestras for making a record for Deutsche Grammophon, the oldest, most respected. Like, if you'd come to me when I was 16 playing guitar for a band in Portchester, New York, to an audience of four people, two of whom were our girlfriends, that's not a recipe for making an orchestral record with Deutsche Grammophon.
I mean, you had incredible success in what, 1999?
I'd say, like, with some qualified objectivity, the commercial period where there's a lot of commercial success was really like 2000 to 2004.
Does Deutsche Grammophon feel like a bigger deal to you than everybody listening to what was the album Now, right?
It depends on what country, but basically the albums Play, 18, and Hotel, like those were the three back when album sales were measured in millions or tens of millions. You know, now album sales are measured in zeros and zeros of zeros because nobody buys albums, which is fine. But this, I mean, like artistically, like especially the way in which I made the record was so different than how I normally work. Because normally I'm in my studio where I'm sitting right now. It's quite small and it's just me by myself. And this involved, you know, like as I said, a gospel choir, 30 different guest vocalists, percussionists, drummers, engineers, conductors, arrangers, string quartets, brass sections, orchestras, et cetera. Like it was so many people. And it was just so interesting to end up with something that I think has this like really wonderful emotional depth to it.
So not everybody knows that you founded Little Pine, a vegan restaurant in Silver Lake, right? Really great place. We've been there together a couple of times. I've been there without you a couple of times. And now there's a cookbook.
Yeah. So the restaurant itself, I no longer own the restaurant. When the pandemic started, I had to learn how to shut down a restaurant in the middle of the apocalypse. And considering I barely knew how to run a restaurant, shutting it down, suffice it to say, it was not a clean, smooth, simple process, and it created a lot of ill will around it on the part of the people who had worked there. It got a little messy, and I'm sure, absolutely sure, I could have done a better job, but it's hard to close down a restaurant during the apocalypse when family members around you are dying and are sick, and when no one has ever shut down a restaurant during the apocalypse before. Like, it's very unprecedented. So it was very challenging. But then luckily, two friends of mine who actually have experience running restaurants bought it from me. I lost money, but still, like, the fact that it could stay open. And I just realized restaurants are kind of like airplanes. Like, they should only be operated by people who know what they're doing. Because when I ran Little Pine, like, luckily the people around me knew what they were doing, but like, I was clueless. I knew how to turn on the lights and I knew how to press play on Spotify. Beyond that, I was just clueless.
You either hired the right people or you encouraged the people you did hire to produce good food because the food was great.
Well, partially, I brought the ethos to it without an understanding of how anything was actually made. And so to that end, I knew when I ran it and owned it that I wanted it to be very, and I guess this is, I don't know if this is a real term, but like vegetable forward, you know, and I wanted it to be sort of this intersection between like high end and populist, you know, like I wanted to challenge people a little bit, but also reach them where they were, you know, inspired by, you know, actually like when I lived in New York, being brought to non-vegan restaurants when they would make vegan food. And I would be so, I was like, wow, this is kind of sad in the way that the best vegan food is being made by non-vegan chefs. And I wanted to sort of borrow that ethos without being too academic. Because as we know, like there are a lot of restaurants that go down the academic route and it photographs well. It's beautiful to talk about, but you don't want to eat it three times a week. I wanted this to have that sort of like that intersection between populist and challenging.
As I said, I really like it. I hope it stays close enough to the way it was the last time I was there. Because every time I ate there, I really thought it was, and as you know, I'm not a vegan, so I have no sort of reason in principle to go there. I just liked it.
I think they've gone a little more populist, which, as they know what they're doing, I'm sure they have good reasons for it. Because obviously, like, when I helped craft the menu, I was clueless. So I would say, oh, let's have, you know, sriracha glazed Brussels sprouts. And my chef would be like, well, you do understand that involves ordering 20 ingredients we're currently not using. So, and it involves someone spending 2 hours a day prepping. So like, I had to learn that you can't have every item on a menu be bespoke and unique. Like when we first opened, I wanted to have, I love good hand-rolled vegan pasta. So we had hand-rolled agnolotti in this truffled cream sauce. And at some point, my chef came to me and said, you know, we have someone on staff whose only job is making agnolotti. And I was like, oh, yeah. So I guess I'm an idiot. Like this is why restaurants should be run by people who know what they're doing, not just some, you know, dim-witted bald guy who shows up every now and then with opinions.
Well, how many vegan restaurants are in LA at this point? Do you have any idea?
Well, generally speaking, so I've been a vegan now for 34 years. There are more vegan restaurants in my neighborhood in LA than there were in the entire world 34 years ago. And they just keep coming. And like there's highbrow, there's lowbrow, there's a German vegan restaurant. There are now, I think, 5 vegan pizza places. It's kind of mind-boggling considering, you know, 34 years ago there was Angelica's Kitchen in New York and that was it.
Okay, but so the Little Pine Cookbook is coming out, but and it has your name on it, but that's sort of your last Little Pine thing.
I think so, and I'm hoping, I mean, like, because Little Pine, I ran it as a nonprofit. Any profits that came in went to animal rights organizations, so I never took a penny from it. In fact, I lost money on it, but the cookbook will be the same thing. Any profits that are generated will go, I'm either going to pick like 5 animal rights organizations or maybe just one. I mean, the organization I work most closely with is the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, basically because it's all doctors. And as a result, it's just there's a weight. When they say something, it's not just college dropout vegans like me with opinions. These are doctors and researchers who, when they say something, it's really, it carries that weight.
We have this whole other interview we did 2 years ago that we're going to merge with this one. So we don't need to go into, there's a lot of stuff we don't need to go into. I really would like to talk about what you're listening to, although maybe no one else is interested in that, but I am because we've had good conversations about music and I'm just curious what, in between making this orchestral stuff, what's turning you on these days? Clearly not 19-year-old pop singers.
I mean, every now and then, you know, like when I first heard Billie Eilish, I was like, what a voice. Like, I mean, like I fully understand why she became this phenomenon because just largely her voice. I mean, the music is great, but that voice is so distinctive. What I'm listening to, I'm a little ashamed. And maybe we talked about this last time where when I first got Spotify on my phone, I thought, okay, I'm a middle-aged guy, but through Spotify, I'm going to stay up to date. Like I'm going to know what the kids are listening to. And I have almost exclusively used Spotify as a nostalgia machine. You know, like, I don't know if I've listened to anything on Spotify that was made in the last 30 years. You know, so it's even going back to like listening to a lot of early classical music, a lot of Baroque music, but then a lot of the punk rock I grew up with, everything from the Gun Club to Devo to New Order to the, I mean, I had this rabbit hole where I sort of started listening to a lot of Cars, like the band The Cars. I don't know why they're so fast. Like they don't make any sense to me, but they're great because they're like the least attractive pop group of all time. And it almost felt like there were these alien lizards who came to Earth to perfect pop music without fully understanding it.
Is it more than like 3 good songs? Because when I listen to The Cars, it's like...
I was surprised when I went to Spotify and looked at like The Cars' greatest hits. I was like, oh, there's like 10 great pop songs there.
I just listened to Just What I Needed. It's the only one I care about, actually.
Listen to Let the Good Times Roll because it's menacing. Like it's... I remember when it was... When it was on AM radio, when it came out, like you remember like in whenever, the late 70s, like you couldn't escape it. You go back and listen to it, it actually feels like performance art. I mean, it's such a good pop song,
But the way it's sung and constructed, it's definitely like these are like bizarre artists and not necessarily just pop musicians. So that's an example of like going down these nostalgia rabbit holes. And of course, our shared love like of Roxy Music and early Brian Ferry. In fact, it was seeing Brian Ferry perform with an orchestra that led me to make this record with Deutsche Grammophon.
That's really cool. Did you talk to him about it?
He did it at the Hollywood Bowl. And I went backstage and I'd never met Brian Ferry. I mean, obviously, he was just delightful. Like, he was so exactly what you'd expect. Like, even backstage, like wearing a beautiful suit, soft-spoken, very genteel and polite. Like, he's a, but then when I was backstage, I talked to the woman who books the LA Philharmonic, and then I did a show with the LA Philharmonic, and that led to making this record.
I got to see if there's a recording of that Brian Ferry with the orchestra, because I would like that, I bet.
The Hollywood Bowl wasn't, I mean, it's a wonderful place, but like you don't really hear the acoustics of an orchestra. That's why when I did my LA Philharmonic show, I did it at Disney Concert Hall, because I was like, if I'm going to play with a 130-piece orchestra, I want to hear the orchestra, not just the orchestra through microphones, but you want to hear the live acoustic, you know, surround sound orchestra.
So is there anything that's been made since 1990 or so that you're listening to?
Well, the one thing that comes to mind is Burial. It was this British artist, I don't know his real name, and he made one record, I forget what it's called, and it's one of the most special electronic music albums I've ever heard. It won a bunch of awards when it came out. I wish I could remember what it's called. It's got a drawing of like a guy wearing a hoodie sweatshirt on the front, and it's that special. And of course, I love James Blake, but I also resent James Blake because I really wanted him to sing on my orchestral album and he wasn't able to do it. So like, I haven't been listening to much James Blake just purely as a result of my petulance and resentment.
There you go. I'm glad you're not too grown up yet. William Bevan, that's the Burial guy. And the album that you might be thinking of is Burial. It's called Burial. Named the album of the year. His second album was called Untrue.
Yeah, I don't remember, again, because of Spotify, I just know whatever that record, it's got a dark cover with an illustration on it. And it's sonically, it's he just did something that I'd never heard before, which like he's working in this sort of genre of like hip hop inspired dance music, but it's fascinating.
Listen, I'm getting a little more into that kind of dubby stuff than I used to be. What I try to force myself to do is I read reviews of current stuff in either The Guardian, which does a great job, or Pitchfork, which, you know, that's what they do. And then I use Spotify the same way. I just put them in a queue. Things I've never heard of, would never listen to. I just put them in a queue and I either start saving them or deleting them. And it just gets me to listen to stuff. And then I wind up, you know, liking one out of 10 things. But still, it's all stuff I never would have heard of if I didn't do it that way.
I mean, I do something similar. Like if the New Yorker, they'll have an article about like a new pop star or like this super interesting musician making their new record. And I'll go to Spotify waiting to be blown away. And I'm like, oh, okay. And this has always been the case with the music press. There's so much unwarranted hyperbole around things. And so it builds up. You're like, wow, I'm going to go listen to this revolutionary, phenomenal new musician make. And then you listen to it and you're like, oh, it's a pop song. Or like it's a person with the guitar and maybe they're fine, but it's certainly, they're not, this is not, you know, I don't know, Led Zeppelin 4. It's not Goat's Head Soup. It's not, you know, like it's not London Calling. It's some person in Brooklyn making a record that is a solid C+.
Okay. I have one recommendation for you. And that's this band called, and I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right, Tyr, T-E-Y-R. And I believe they're Welsh, one Welsh person, one Scottish person, one Irish person. And it is like folk classical. I think it's genreless. I think it's really, really good. So try that. It's on Spotify. Okay, the album's coming out May 28th. We may air after that, but thanks for joining me. Before we get too deep into summer, before things get away from us, one more recipe that you probably can't make in August, but you can probably still make now. And you may be able to make again in September, but that is strawberry and arugula salad. It's a weird combination. They're both super strong tasting. They are contradictory, contrasting flavors. This is the easiest, most unusual, and one of the most wonderful salads there is. So take 3 or 4 cups of strawberries, but good ones, obviously. Hull them, or don't hull them, but trim off the little green leaves on top. Halve them or quarter them, depending what size they are, and combine them with about an equal amount of arugula. Again, 3 or 4 cups, maybe a little more arugula. Toss that with some olive oil, 2 tablespoons, 3 tablespoons, enough so that the whole thing is glossy, and the best balsamic you can lay your hands on, about a tablespoon. Add a pinch of salt and taste that. That is the dish. And it is a surprising and wonderful and delicious salad. And time is running out. You probably won't find much arugula in August, but both arugula and strawberries come back strong in the fall. So July and September for this dish. Okay, it's time for some questions. As always, you can ask your questions by calling 833-FOOD-POD. That's 833-366-3763.
Hi, this is Samantha calling from Middlebury. I wanted to ask what your favorite pizza toppings are.
Well, Samantha from Middlebury, Connecticut, who asks, what are your favorite pizza toppings? This is a story. I don't really like pizza toppings. I like pizza. And I grew up at a time when 90% of pizza, I grew up in New York, and 90% of the time pizza was sliced pizza, i.e. for 15 or 20 cents. The price went up when I was about 10. You would get a slice of pizza that was made with decent mozzarella, decent tomato sauce, some olive oil and oregano that was always on there, and a real chewy crust. And I think the quality of sliced pizza, every New Yorker who's of a certain age will tell you this quality of sliced pizza has declined dramatically. But for whatever reason, I liked cheese pizza. I didn't want anything else on there. Occasionally some sausage or peppers or onions. Onions I like, but I don't go for lots of stuff. I certainly don't go for salad on top of pizza or barbecue chicken or any of this kind of crazy new stuff. I am very much a traditionalist, so I'm sure this is a disappointing answer, but that's me. I realize it's not a popular opinion, but that is the way I feel about that.
Hi, this is Lynn from New York. Here's a question for you. Why do the guys who work at Xi'an Famous Foods slap the noodles on the counter really hard before boiling them?
Interesting question, this noodle question, and Melissa is going to take it. Melissa.
So a couple of years ago, I was doing an article about noodle pulling, and I went to Taiwan with a Pittsburgh restaurant owner, and the guy's name is Mike Chen. He's amazing, and he owns this restaurant called Everyday Noodles, and it's based on this chain called Din Tai Fung. Anyhow, he knows a lot about noodles and has to buy special flour and hire people who are really good at what they do because this whole restaurant is based just on these pulled noodles. So when we got your question, I called him up and I said, what is the deal with the banging of the dough on the counter? Is it like doing something to the dough, like kneading it in some way, or does it have some positive effect? And he said, no. Most of the time, you'll see noodle pulling in an open kitchen of some sort, and it is just to get people's attention. It is purely for the show. That's all I got. I hope it helps.
That's it for this week's listener questions. If you have a question about food, cooking, whatever, call us at 833-FOOD-POD. That's 833-366-3763. It is midsummer. We are awash in vegetables. I hope today's recipes will be helpful. They're really good ones. Just a word about midsummer and what your refrigerator probably looks like or should look like, which is just crammed with vegetables that you're dying to cook. And we are starting to get into, or we have gotten into, what I like to call hard vegetables. Not just leafy things, but cucumbers, summer squash, and every year there are more and more summer squash on the market that you haven't seen before. I mentioned before that I cooked something for lunch that I didn't quite know what it was. I would call it a bitter melon, and it looks like a bitter melon, but I got it at an Indian market, and I don't know what it would be called there, but awesome. I made that with some eggplant and some ginger and garlic. I just think it's the best time of year to be a cook, and a time that you can really make your diet more and more plant forward and enjoy it like you can enjoy it at no other time of year. So keep cooking, have fun. We will see you next time. I want to thank my passionately vegan but not crazy or scary about it friend Moby for coming on the show. You can find him anywhere, obviously, but follow him on Instagram at Moby, Twitter at The Little Idiot, and Facebook at Moby Music. I like a guy who varies his handles. Folks, if you liked today's episode, and if you're still listening, I can assume that you did, then please subscribe to Food with Mark Bittman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you like to listen. It would be real helpful if you left us a 5-star review on Apple, and detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. You can find the recipe from today's show in the episode show notes or at bittmanproject.com or at markbittman.com. They all kind of go to the same place. Finally, Food with Mark Bittman is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Check out Airwave's other shows at airwavemedia.com or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Mark Bittman, and thanks again for listening to Food. See you next week.